Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any moment. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues as they go from being impossible to plausible to policy, and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, it looks like the modern internet needs more servers to keep giving people what they're asking of it. And some people are very concerned about this, arguing that this will push electricity costs onto normal consumers that will drain needed water supplies and cause nuisances to the neighbors of data centers. And to talk about this, I am joined by founder and principal of LVL Strategies, Dennis Tenuto, who spent 45 years working in tech and has been a consultant for data center developers. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
People have been building these facilities for decades. Why are data centers an issue now?
I think the primary concern that's really driving the paranoia and the noise level is basically the size and the scope of data centers. So back 20, 30 years ago, you might have, say, a 50 or 100,000 square foot data center that might draw 4 megawatts of power. And now you've got, half a million square feet of data center that's drawing 500 megawatts to a gigawatt just for one site. So I think the size the facilities, the acreage involved, I think that's what's really driving the noise level.
And so that the scope then matters because if it's just like, if it's using a normal office size location and normal office size amount of power, it's like the system can handle that. Everything's kind of built for that. But when it gets to be much, much larger, like some of these things are, maybe there are issues with electricity supply, with noise and pollution, and with water usage. Is that kind of it?
Basically, in a nutshell. But I think the other aspect that's driving the size is the actual applications and the workloads. Mm-hmm. So in bygone days, if you were in banking, there was a lot of transactional computer operations, right? People swiping credit cards, tellers making deposits. Those are very transactional in nature. The same thing in healthcare, although healthcare had some large data models, basically around imaging, right? X-rays, MRIs, those were much larger files compared to, say, a checking operation. And the same in automotives. There were a variety of applications that would be very transactional in nature. AI has changed that to what they call the large language models, which are basically human interaction is very conversational. You can ask all types of questions, some requiring large amounts of compute and storage in order to give you the answer.
So we've got these things. They're a little bit different from what they used to be. Can people build these hyperscale data centers by right? That is, without further approvals from state and local governments?
Well, I'm a firm believer that property owners do have rights. They have property rights, but they should abide by local zoning, right? So granted, you may have some acreage or you might have some old buildings on a piece of property that you want to redevelop into something else. As a property owner, as somebody that believes in the capital markets, I believe you have the right to develop your property within the scope of the local zoning. Where I think we get to the elevated noise level in today's politics, in today's media, is where it becomes a top-down, where the large developers come into a state or locale, and the state governance, whatever, wherever it emanates from, whether it's the governorship or the legislature or some other entity, is saying, okay, you can take this 500 acres or 1,000 acres of virgin timberland, or, you know, 500 acres of this corn farm, and do with it as you wish.
Are some of these states using the powers of eminent domain to take property from some people to hand over to data center developers?
They're definitely trying. And, you know, there are some, like I understand there's one that just recently started moving forward, where I think it was in Saline, Michigan, where the township realized that a protracted court battle with greater powers would certainly deplete the township of financing, right? They're just not structured, and they don't have the deep pockets to mount a vigorous defense of the local environment. And I don't think that's what the founders intended when crafting our constitutional republic, is local rights, local control, the rights of the property owners.
Well, let me push back on that point, because I actually have done a lot of work on eminent domain. We've got a study about some of the state's long history on this. And of course, we're very much supportive of a constitutional amendment here that prohibited the use of eminent domain to take private property and give it to other private actors in the name of economic development. But look, as far as basic civics are concerned, all these local governments are creatures of state policy. There are no local government constitutions. There are state constitutions, and it's the state that kind of came together, various states that came together to create the federal government. And like the limits of what we want to ask local governments to do, and how they are best set up to serve local interests, is fundamentally a state question. How much control and over what should be done. But I mean that's kind of some of my views. Did you want to talk some more about that from your perspective?
So I think there's a fundamental difference between state exercising eminent domain over a piece of property.
Mm-hmm. For listeners, eminent domain is say, look, the state government is for the state's benefit, and if our elected lawmakers say that, look, your private property can be better served state interests as a highway or public infrastructure or something else, and the state government is eminently the domain of the state to take over that property if it is going to be used for to provide public benefits. And some of the controversies over time is a public benefit economic development. We've had a lot of Supreme Court cases about that. We've had there's been a 19th century jurisprudence concern here in the state of Michigan, where they said, no, you can't do that, in addition to new constitutional amendments. Sorry for the digression.
No, I get it. That's pretty much where I was going to go. In past cases of eminent domain, somebody had to prove that there was a public benefit that would come from the use of the particular land, whether replacing a decrepit bridge that is no longer functional or a hazard, right? So you have to put in a new bridge or a new roadway to alleviate serious congestion.
I can see on this case, if some lawmaker might think, look, these servers are basically the 21st century roads. They got to have somewhere so we can take money or take private property from some people.
No.
Compensation and give it to these private developers.
No, that's the difference. These are private developers for profit. These are for-profit entities. They're corporations. And clearly, their number one focus is going to be their stakeholders and shareholders, and of making sure that this becomes a profitable project for them. That's quite different than, you know, falling down infrastructure that needs to be replaced or, you
know, public access roadway.
Aging power lines, right, that, you know, were put in 100 years ago. And the poles are falling over, the wires is corroding. You have to do something. So there's a difference between public benefit and private profit.
Yeah, I think so too. And so does the Michigan State Constitution, but not every state constitution. But to go back on why you think it's important to be, or for these things to be regulated at the local level. I mean, here in the state of Michigan, like, it's an interesting because we have some places where you can build a data center by right, and then there are other places that have a complete moratorium on building a data center in their area. So it's a huge variance for it. So why do some places want to ban them completely, and other ones think and other places think that they're fine, I guess?
So I think there's a number of issues at play, and one of the hardest nuts to crack right now in the media is what I call fear porn. Right? Mm-hmm. There's so much fear being raised in the media about the power that's going to be consumed, what it's going to do to the ratepayers, the water that's going to be consumed, the land, the wildlife. There is literally no end, it seems, to the daily news feed on these large, what are called hyperscaler data centers, versus what was built 20, 30 years ago that would neatly tuck in on, you know, a 5 or a 10 acre piece of land, and would be, you know, basically tucked away on some side street, and you just wouldn't know it.
It has no greater externalities, no greater influence on the economy than any other office space.
Well, they were all for profit, for the benefit of the corporations they serve. I worked for a systems integrator that is no longer around, EDS, and we had data centers all over the place. That we didn't necessarily build for ourselves, we built to service other clients. So we were a services provider, obviously for profit, for the benefit of our clients who asked us to help them with perhaps runaway costs, you know, runaway usage issues, I mean, management issues. There were a number of reasons why they would come to somebody like an EDS or an IBM and say, hey, could you take this small data center out of my basement? We've outgrown the facilities, and could you host it somewhere? And for the most part, there's a street not far from my house. I can drive down. I can tell you there's at least 5 data centers on that one street that's less than a quarter mile long.
Okay, so... Why is the developers interested in some areas but not others, some place not other? How do the economics make sense for them?
Well, these, I mean, obviously a business case would have to be made for why you would enter into a capital project such as building a data center in the first place. It's going to cost you tens of millions of dollars to build this data center, whatever size and scale met your business criteria, 50,000 feet, 100,000 square feet. and what workloads would you put in them? Mm-hmm. We had multiple data centers in that class, 75 to 100,000 square feet, and different data centers were designed and they were structured to handle different workloads because of the workload profile. So we would run automotive engineering in these two particular data centers, and we would run banking and financial in a couple of other different data centers because the application profiles were completely different. What is really driving the agenda today, what's driving the media noise today, are not these 100,000 square feet data centers, many of which there's many buildings. There are literally hundreds and hundreds in the Detroit metropolitan area. Many of them are just simply in the basements of the companies that run them. And people drive by them every day and have no idea what's in that what's in that building. It looks like offices above ground. Below ground, it could be 50 or 100,000 feet of raised floor running, you know, rooms full of computers. Right? But these hyperscalers, AI, and what they intend to use it for is what's driving the agenda for these hyperscaler sites that are so large and require so much energy that many of them require their own power generation right on site. Many of them require special cooling facilities built on site. All of that takes acreage and acreage to build these out. And aside from the application, a lot of it is driven by the physics of the technology. I gave a presentation not too long ago here in Rochester where I compared to what's in my laptop. So on this video conference, I'm running it from a Dell Intel laptop, and it's got a single processor about 2 inches, and it's got what's called 16 cores, right? So in that one processor, there are 16 individual processors called cores. Some of these AI processors that go into the same 19-inch racks could have 17,000 cores. There's a company that's even designed one that has like 200,000 cores on one chip. But the chip is like almost a foot by a foot, and it's got 200,000 cores. These are designed to handle workloads that are well beyond the transactional, right? So think about people using their voice or their keyboard to write an application program using large language models, right? You don't even need to be a trained coder these days, knowing, you know, the different programming languages. You can just tell AI, I want this application to do this, to do this, to do that, and here's the output that I'm looking for. And it's very generalized, but that's essentially what happens. The more you ask the computer to do for you, the greater the power that you need. You need more CPUs, you need more memory, you need more storage, which means you need more power, you need more cooling, you need more space. And that's why these sites have gone from 100,000 square feet to 1 million square feet, the sheer amount of equipment.
So I want to know more about the business case for these hyperscale things then. Like, are they selling rack space within this, or are they just saying, look, there's a huge demand for this AI, we can sell a lot of stuff. They need what we're going to offer. So if we can get one of these things off the ground and it has to be this massive size in order for the economics to work. I'm going to just back off. Please explain to me the business case for this so that I don't make myself look like an idiot for talking about things that are well beyond my my experience.
No, and I will, it would be very easy for me to get very technical and your audience would tune out in 2 minutes. So I will try to keep it at a high enough level. So think about where Google was 20, 25 years ago. I remember when Google first came out and, you know, people were raving, you've got to see this. You can open up this thing called a browser on the World Wide Web, and you could ask a question and it would find something for you. So that's just a very high-level search application, right? So it's total knowledge. What Google had at its disposal was whatever it could ingest into memory and then index, right? So it would create little pointers for every little piece of information that it knew about. And it would throw enough computing and memory power at it that it would provide a response very, very quickly, within a second or so of, you know, depending on how you structured the search. AI is taking it to a whole nother level where you're using large language modeling, essentially human language. You can speak to it if you don't want to type to it. And it will recognize your everyday vernacular, and it would filter that, it would sort that, it would come to a digital understanding of what those bits and bytes meant, what you asked it to do, and then it would start to assemble. It would go find all that information and pull it together into a finished project. So you hear stories all the time about high school and college kids cheating on a report, right? That they don't have to sit down and do the research and bang out this report, typing for, you know, hours and hours, you know, many nights after midnight to produce this report. They could just go to AI and say, I need to write a report on Paul Revere. It needs to be a minimum of 12 pages. I need to know everything about Paul Revere from his birth to his death and everything he did in between. And AI will go do exactly that. And then once you have the rough product, of course, you can iteratively ask AI to fine tune the output into a finished report.
Okay, so I know that, familiar with that. But what's the deal with these hypers? Like, and I know that like asking one of these AI models to do this stuff is a huge endeavor. It requires chips, it requires electricity, and therefore, like you need these big data centers to do that, or maybe not, or it just makes more sense to do it in these bigger data centers. So how do they get paid?
Well, they get paid by big companies that that need them. So, for instance, Google used to create large data centers just for to house all the computers and networking equipment for searching. Think about Amazon. I mean, where Jeff Bezos has taken his company from selling books, which was a highly transactional process using a web browser. I need to browse to your catalog of all the books in your warehouse, and I'm going to pick these books and drop ship them to my house. And here's my credit card, right? Very transactional. But as these corporations evolve, they are wanting to sell higher order services. So don't just give me data. I'm asking a question. You provide data transactionally. Give me context. Give me scope. Give me some depth behind that to help me understand what those data points actually mean. And all of that takes compute. They get paid by, you know, Amazon is still in business. They've expanded their portfolio from just books to pretty much everything under the sun. And then you've got Amazon Prime Video, which now has terabytes and terabytes of video movies stored in those data centers. And with a couple of clicks of a mouse, You can call up pretty much any movie you want and watch it on demand. All of that takes power and networking and storage to be able to do that. There's always going to be, though, a paying customer, right? There's somebody at the end of that transaction that's paying that, whether you're buying the book or you're paying to rent that movie for $1.99 or $3.99, whatever they're charging for that particular movie. But now you get into some really high-end, higher-order thinking where you're trying to solve grander challenges. There's still, I think, a space out there for what used to be called the grand challenges, but I will say grander challenges, where an engineer would really have to crank on some math models, either in a spreadsheet or on his desktop, his laptop. He's trying to solve an engineering function. Well, there are AI models out there. I mean, there's several types of AI that are now in the wild. There are AI models that literally can take you down an engineering path and say, you know, I need to design a car body surface that has these parameters, right? And it's going to fit on this particular car. Every time you go up the pole into higher order thinking, there is going to be a penalty to pay for that higher order thinking, and it's going to be paid in numbers of chips and power and cooling and so forth and space. Ultimately, who's going to pay for these things? In my presentation about data centers, the AI and the hyperscaler data centers, I think there's a conversation that just doesn't happen in our culture and really needs to happen. There are people that are afraid of these data centers, and so their conversations are driven by fear, much less understanding. And I think the big understanding that needs to happen is the product or service being delivered is no longer that book, that video, or that automotive component. It is you and me. We are the product. All right? So our image, our likeness, our voice, what we think, what we feel, right? Because don't forget, these large language models are being fed by people that are typing in complete paragraphs or speaking everything that they want. And so eventually the AI model you're working with knows quite a bit about you. And so your image, your likeness, your desires, your feelings, how you feel about politics, one way or the other, party or person, how you feel about the economy and banking, how do you feel about automotives, healthcare, name it. Over time, who you are, James, and how you think, how you feel, you become the product. And then the owners who are paying for that data center, and I'll get into some of that area in a second, but ultimately who you are, what you are, and what you do becomes a product that is mineable, and they will sell that either individually or collectively. So over time, they may know in this particular geographic area that is considered very old school, very conservative, very down. You hear the comments about the Midwest values, right, versus East Coast or West Coast. All of those people individually and collectively are going to provide information. They're going to provide the data points that are eventually going to be mined and used by those that are paying for it.
I mean, like, to some extent, that's been going on for a while. Like, Google's biggest function was obviously to help people find what they're looking for on the internet, but also to help businesses try to get to their customers better, cheaper, faster, and more effective than alternative means. That's what social media does too. It collects a bunch of information about you, and especially for things that are like, look, this is where you are in space. And so businesses that are near you might want to be marketed to the people who are their potential customers. This adds another level of creepiness, which I assume like would be really bad for social control or governments that want to do that, but for helping you find the cheapest, fastest, or the cheapest, most effective dehumidifier, a little bit less offensive. What do you think?
Yeah. So this is where the conversation needs to go. So I remember years and years ago working for a company that was in the data center space, IT space, in the financial services space. The joke was some of the most concentrated set of employees on Wall Street were psychologists and psychiatrists with PhDs working for banking companies. And you originally, people would scratch their head and say, what are you talking about? Psychiatrists working for banks is because they are sitting down with the application developers, the coders for these complex IT systems, and they're helping them analyze the financial transactions for both the bank accounts as well as, more importantly, the credit cards. Every time they're swiped, every time you go to the store and you buy something and you swipe that credit card, they can tie that number, that purchase, to you as a person, and using psychiatric and psychological profiles, they can develop very good, very accurate profiles of the individual and their purchasing tastes, their habits. And that's how things started to evolve with social media. You didn't need that transactional stuff anymore. You just opened up Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever, and before you know it, after using the product for a while, you're getting these pop-ups and these ads. You know, like, wait a minute, I didn't ask for that. Well, you went to visit this, and now you're starting to get all these ads for car parts or, clothing or whatever it is. And so they've codified a lot of that original work is now codified throughout social media apps. Where this gets creepy, to your point, James, is when unregulated powers get to use that information for purposes beyond the intended scope of the application or its usage. And I will go right to the end case. I'll go right to, there's some creepiness of, when you first log in and you open up your social media and now you get an ad for, a vacation spot that you were just talking to your wife. You never typed it in. Well, how did it know? Well, your microphone is on, right? Your microphone on your computer is on, and you may have your camera on. And so it knows, you're looking for this, and now you're going to see it in your social media. That's one level of creepy. Going to the other end is what happened in China with the Wuxi code, right? So this goes back. WUXI, the Wuxi code, was a program of the Communist Chinese Party to basically know and control its citizens nationwide.
Oh, and, sorry. I have heard about the social credit score thing.
Oh, yes. Credit scoring is what it evolved from. It evolved from the Wuxi code. So think about the enormous amount of compute platform or compute capacity and network capacity to tie your compute usage, you know, your laptop on your MSP, your ISP, your browsing habits. Your bank accounts are all online and digitized. Now you have security cameras everywhere, scanning everything from facial imagery to license plates, your credit card, your credit card swiping patterns, you know, which restaurants you're going to. I mean, if you go to the same, if you're a creature of habit and you happen to use the same restaurant and the same credit card every Saturday, every Wednesday night, guess what? Now you have trained that model with a certain pattern. So what the Chinese Communist Party have done with the Wuchi Code and social scoring is literally wholesale control over their population. This was just a conspiracy theory until this year. People in technology knew what was going on. Back in the 20 teens, there was a Google like fellow level engineer, like one of the most brilliant. He also happened to be a Stanford PhD and professor who was on a Google project in China. And when he realized what he was there for and what he was there to do, he resigned. He said, I will not work on something to enslave the nation. And he famously, or infamously, depending on which side of the table you sit, he resigned and never went back. He would not do that work. And so there were these legends, there were these rumors, there were these, you know, of course, some people like to drop it in the can and, conspiracy theory, stay away from that, don't even talk about that. Well, there's been some news that has come out of China, that has escaped China, where middle-class people, I mean, we're not talking about vagrants, we're not talking about uneducated people, but middle-class people who had jobs are now penniless and sleeping on the streets, right? Because they are locked out of their cars. They are unable to use trains, planes, boats. They're unable to access their places of work or even their own apartments. And they have no source of income. Their credit cards are shut off. Their phones don't work anymore. And truly, you have a government agency that has basically used early AI to basically tap into everything about a individual. And if they don't like who you had dinner with last week, if they don't like a post you made on social media this month, if they don't like, you know, who you were talking to on the bus, push of a button, you're locked out of everything that you once knew as your life. And that's real.
So, all right. But I do want to push back on the AI, on the hyperscale data center AI use. I can see there might be a huge lucrative investment for this type of customer profiling. But are you sure it's not just these big tech companies who have been given wide latitude about spending their investors' dollars in ways that, you know, typical manufacturer can't? Sure, it's not just them setting money on fire trying to chase wherever this thing leads. Why is it got to be that the killer application is customer surveillance? And again, there's a huge difference between doing customer serve or doing this type of customer serve or this type of surveillance in order to control, you know, billions of dollars of, or sorry, billions of people's lives versus, and to ensure that they're not a threat to the powers that be versus selling them more or selling them dehumidifiers that they want.
Right. So this goes way beyond transactional purchases, right? So we are in an arms race, so to speak. And I covered that in more depth in my presentation, that if you look at chip development and memory development and server development. Almost every month, every data center where they started construction, there will be some point in the article about, well, this one is going to be built with this latest set of chips from NVIDIA or the latest set of chips from AMD or whoever. And it is an arms race, and it is happening exceedingly fast. So in the 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks since I originally put the presentation together, two chip manufacturers have announced brand new chips that were not on my radar a month ago that will fit in laptops and desktops that provide, instead of 16 cores, thousands of cores in a laptop. So now you may not even have to go for certain AI workloads. You may not have to go to a data center. No, I'm sure they're going to charge a premium for that, but that arms race with the data centers will continue in perpetuity because it's always about cheaper, faster, better, and what workloads can I accomplish? So what some companies have done in this arms race for intelligence, business intelligence, profitability, market share, is many companies have laid off highly trained staff that have been on staff for years, maybe decades, and now have low-end, younger employees that are perhaps AI savvy that are doing their work because they would rather pay the AI data center owners for the cycle time, for the time on the computers to do that work that used to be done by, a room or a floor full of other employees. I think Oracle, they laid off something like 30,000 employees. Mm-hmm. And these were not slouches. These were not like screwdriver turners in the data center. These were high-end thinkers. These were high-end developers that were working on some of the most powerful databases and data center technologies. And boom, 30,000 gone because they could pay a younger employee less money to go work with an AI agent and codify some of that work using AI. So they would rather pay for that system time in the data center than the human time. But ultimately, though, a lot of the things that people are chasing are still going to require human intelligence. So for instance, I believe in most states, it is law that you cannot use AI for a point of law and go to court with it, right? And say, well, here's what I came up with in my research, right? There has to be a human lawyer that looks at the output and says, this is factual, this is true, I can verify these facts, or this is garbage. And the same thing goes with medicine, right? So doctors are using AI, but at the end of the day, a doctor can't just tell you to go to AI and put in your symptoms and then do whatever AI tells you to, whether it's take a drug or whatever. A doctor still has to interpret the output of his searches and validate, is this factual? Is this really what I should be telling my patient?
All right. So I kind of want to come back and see if I can't tie a couple of things together.
Sure.
And now, which is like this, the data centers are a big issue in part because they've moved from small locations to large locations, massive amounts of power and land. And so there's a normal normal land use concerns that are being made about that. And they're going to wind up through it. And because there's such a huge demand for these things, they can light a whole bunch of money on fire with lawyers to try and deal with this if they can't find other alternative solutions. Although you also mentioned that maybe the technology is going to change so that you don't need these larger locations, or the locations they might have might need less power. Big question mark there.
Or fewer of them, right? Yeah. So as the arm race in chips and memory continue, what originally might have been planned for 1 million square feet now through micronization, they only need 500,000 or 250,000, whatever.
But I want to come back to your other points, which is okay, but what is this all in service of? What are we doing with all of this? And one of the things that I think, again, trying to summarize what you said, is that when it was just about transactions, there are clear agents, there are clear benefits, there's a clear cut that like these tech companies can take. I helped you sell a book. It's cheaper than alternatives. I want my 10%. And it's a win-win situation for all the things involved. But it seems like this technology can be used for massive amounts of social control, massive invasions on people's privacy, where if we're paying for this by just making it easier to advertise to people to get products in front of them, are we all really comfortable with this level of intimate surveillance from these large language models? And I think that's a question that you're raising.
Yeah. So I think pretty much anything that man invents or makes can be abused to the detriment of man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of benefit, right? Clearly, medicine, science, there's tremendous benefit. So you listen to some of the people that want these AI data centers. So a drug manufacturer, for instance, can shorten the cycle time from art to part, from thought to finished product, by using AI technologies to run through modeling of the chemistry for a particular drug. Same thing back in the day in automotives, we had certain sets of computers that were set aside for line surf, body in white, you know, powertrain, you know, solid modeling. And then we had some high-end Cray computers that did all the computational fluid dynamics and so forth, the really high-end modeling to finalize those designs. So now we look at what AI has done. In one single rack, you basically have the power of several Cray computers from 20 years ago in one single rack. So think about what kind of engineering challenges you could use. Think about what Elon did with SpaceX. How could he go from a clean sheet to launch after launch after launch? And yes, there were some failures, but the amount of telemetry data, the amount of information data points that were captured on every model he created, he was running that through AI, and they were iteratively, very rapidly modifying these designs to the point where the failure modes were like the risk was so small comparatively. So there still is the race by businesses to become faster in the marketplace, to become more cost effective, cost competitive. That drive is still there, but we still need to be aware of, just like Google and Facebook and others that took advantage of our use of technology to then capture us, to capture the essence of us, and market to us even when we didn't want it, or even though we felt that it was an invasion of our privacy. there are some privacy concerns. And the fact that AI allows it to happen in mere milliseconds or seconds instead of hours, I think there are some privacy concerns that need to be codified in law and perhaps even in constitutional amendments, right? Protecting our rights as individuals from somebody taking our name, image, and likeness, for taking the essence of our thought processes and commercializing that or using it for a nefarious purpose.
Dennis, we have covered so much, and I feel like we're only scratching the surface, but I think this has really helped us understand what is within the Overton window. So thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.